name is Neil Middleton, and every month we create informative content for you as we talk to important, influential, and inspirational people from the world of bats, as well as other areas of interest. To find out more about Batability, go to batability.co.uk. Now for the interview. Let's do it. And welcome, everybody. This is going to be interesting. Dr. Hannah Muller is from New Zealand, and she is the founder of a company called Phoenix Ecology Limited. We'll find out lots about Hannah in the next hour or so, I am certain. But how are you today, Hannah?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you, Neil?
I'm doing excellent, thank you very much. I'm so excited to be talking to somebody from pretty much the polar opposite side of the world to Great Britain, New Zealand. But you're not in New Zealand at the moment. Explain to our audience who you are at the moment.
Who I am at the moment. Wonderful. I am in Europe at the moment, in Denmark. I've been here a couple of months. I am visiting my partner who lives here at the moment, and I also have family that lives in Germany, so I was spending some time with them. And then I'm going back home next week again into spring. Looking forward to that.
Okay, so you've got, I'm assuming Northwestern Europe, ecology works on a kind of spring, summer, autumn, winter pattern. And as you go into spring, that's when things become a bit busier. Is that accurate, or have I got that totally wrong?
No, that's pretty accurate. Definitely sort of come October, things start to become quite busy for the summer season for us until about February, March normally. So I think there'll be a few busy months ahead.
Sounds good. Well, quick introduction, everybody. Just a little bit more background on Hannah before we get deeper into the interview. As I said already, she's the founder of Phoenix Ecology, based in New Zealand. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. She's a certified environment practitioner and member of the Environment Institute Australia and New Zealand. She's also a member of New Zealand Freshwater Sciences Society and New Zealand Ecological Society. Her specialisms are restoration ecology, wetland ecology, freshwater ecosystems, lake restoration, integrated catchment management, ecosystem services, and if all of that's not enough, we've got to take a breath here, folks. If all of that's not enough, she's also pretty good on bats, avifauna, and lizard ecology. Hannah, does that pretty much describe you accurately? Is there anything you want to add to that or expand upon?
I think that's capture it. I think I'm just a broad generalist ecologist, so I cover a broad range of subjects. I do like to take a big picture look at projects or problems that I'm dealing with from a sort of landscape scale perspective rather than focusing on individual species, although of course at times that is also necessary. Generally that's how I approach my work.
And am I right in saying your PhD, that was based on landscape type approach? Is that correct? Do you want to talk just a little bit about the PhD you did?
Yes. It was focused on lake restoration, but it did take a catchment scale approach to basically improving water quality at the bottom of the catchment, i.e. the lake, and what changes to the catchment are necessary to achieve the desired water quality targets.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe talk a little bit more about that shortly. But what I want to talk about, first of all, are you based in Waikato or close to Waikato, is that correct?
I am based in Waikato, which is the a region just south of Auckland in the North Island. Of New Zealand. So it's sort of right about Hamilton is sort of more or less the center of that region.
Okay. So how far away would you be from Hamilton?
I'm based at the coast, which is about half a 45 minute drive, possibly about 30, 40 kilometres west of Hamilton.
Okay, so that's not too far. Not too far at all then. Yeah.
No.
And as you say, that's on the North Island, south of Auckland. And Wellington is the far south of the North Island, I think. Is that correct? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, it's the basically at the southern tip of the North Island.
Yeah, yeah. And I took this picture here we're looking at of this landscape. I think this came off of your LinkedIn profile. is this typically what you're surrounded by, or is this somewhere special? Tell me about this. Yeah.
Not quite. this is actually the South Island and Kaikoura, which is just north of Christchurch on the eastern side of the South Island. The mountain ranges up there are beautiful. So the South Island generally has a slightly more impressive landscapes compared to the North Island, although we have some very beautiful spots up there as well. But the mountains tend to be a little bit lower and more hill country than big mountain ranges. They're sort of the further south you go, the sort of larger they become.
Okay, no, that's fascinating. So going back to childhood or your teenage years, where did your interest in environmental, matters, etc., where did that stem from? Was that, were you always destined to be what you are now, or was it something that happened later on as you finished school? What's the backtrack there? What's the background there?
I definitely stumbled into what I'm doing now a little bit by accident. But having said that, I always did have a very large passion for nature and animals and sort of the outdoors. And I was always fascinated by the little critters and the big critters. And I think from basically kindergarten age onwards, I very much enjoyed that and did a lot of reading on all sorts of things, biology and wildlife. I did consider becoming a vet at some point, but then got sidetracked, and my family are all scientists, so I guess ending up as a biologist sort of a bit of a good middle ground. It was definitely not a straight line from A to B, with lots of detours and sidetracks and whatever happens. I'm really happy with where I've ended up. I really, really enjoy the work that I do most of the time. Of course, we all have challenging days, but very happy with that.
Yeah, yeah. Could have you ever envisaged as someone in your late teens that you would be the owner of your own environmental ecological consultancy type business? Would have you ever imagined that being something that was going to happen?
Probably not in my late teens, if I'm honest. No. I have been dreaming about it for a little while, but probably not that early on.
Okay. And you went to university at, I think it's pronounced the University of Waikato. And that's where you did, I think, all of your academic work. Is that correct? You did your PhD there, but I think prior to your PhD, is that where you did your master's as well?
I did do my master's there as well. Yeah, I didn't do my undergrad there aside from one semester. But the master's and also the PhD was at Waikato Uni.
Just tell us a little bit more about the PhD and how that came about.
Probably one of those semi-accidents.
Okay.
I was actually working part-time at a ecological consultancy before I started my PhD, and felt that perhaps doing a little bit more education around ecology, biology would be beneficial to kind of progressing my career and gaining a little bit more experience. And then a PhD program, sort of a research program was put out, and I applied for that, and that was the lake restoration research that I ended up doing. And I just thought that sounded like a really interesting project to be part of, because it was very much focused on finding solutions to issues that we're facing in New Zealand that can be applied later on. I obviously very much appreciate theoretical research, and we need a lot more of that, but I was really fascinated by the applied nature of actually trying to find solutions to on the ground problems. And so, I spent the next 4 years researching that, and I really did enjoy that and what came out of it.
And I know on ResearchGate, I think I'm right in saying on ResearchGate, and folks, you can find Hannah on ResearchGate. I think you've got some academic publications there. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, so the PhD, I would imagine that would have been tough, yeah? Or did you find it mostly enjoyable? I mean, what aspects of it did you find challenging?
Definitely challenging, also very enjoyable. I really enjoyed the subject matter and the research that I was actually doing. I think generally PhDs can be a little bit of a tough experience because you're sort of needing to find your own way, and it can be quite lonely at times, and obviously a lot of hard work goes in, and I was also working at the same time as I was doing my PhD, just to add a little bit of extra challenge to that. So definitely had some pretty busy weeks to get through, but I think I enjoyed the fact that I also had something else to focus on. A PhD is a very much a long-term project, more of a marathon than a sprint, and having sort of smaller projects to focus on the side that you can actually start and complete within a month or two was definitely something that gave me a little bit of sanity going through the process of the long haul slog at the same time.
If you're enjoying listening to our podcasts, perhaps you would also be interested in joining Batability Club. To find out more about Club, which includes hundreds of hours of accessible training resources available to you in your own time and at your pace, go to batability.co.uk. Thank you. So you say you were working at the same time. Was that still within the ecological consultancy, or was it doing other things?
Yes. Yeah. It was just part-time, of course, but it was good to get a little bit of diversity. And sometimes you can just spend a day out in the field doing something that isn't related to your PhD. I think that was a really good balance, even though it created a bit of a bigger workload, but I think that was a good way of doing it.
Yeah. Good stuff. And you were telling me just before we pressed the record button about hobbies and interests outside of work. Let's talk about this now. So you mentioned hiking. You quite like running. So pretty kind of normal stuff, folks. And then you just threw in there kite surfing. Yeah. So are these things that have always interested you, or are these things that are more recent additions to your personal life? I mean, tell us a little bit about what you're doing when you're not at work. Yeah.
Not very recent additions. I mean, running has been a little bit of a love-hate relationship for a while, but in the last maybe decade or so, I've sort of really started enjoying trail running, which is obviously beautiful, and places like we can see in the photo there, it's definitely not a bad spot to go for a run. and then kitesurfing, I have been doing for about 10 or 12 years now, so a little while. Very, very much enjoy getting out on the ocean and just kind of turning off life and doing something a little bit out there that is fun. So yeah, definitely very, very, very happy with the spread of hobbies that I've got.
No, that's good. Well, it gets you outdoors and it's keeping you fit. And
yeah.
And I do quite a bit of running. Okay, I don't do long distances anymore. I'm not particularly fast. I'm not as fast as I used to be, but I don't know about you, but I find when I'm doing a run, especially if it's a route that I'm familiar with, I can just totally switch off to the point that I don't even understand how I maybe past some point of the run that I never even noticed, but has to be there because my brain is just totally zoned out of everything. Do you get that? Do you get a bit of that yourself? Do you?
Definitely. Yeah. At least in places where I've run a lot. I really enjoy that. I mean, it's nice to, especially when you're on the trails, to discover new places and sort of stop and take photos and go, wow, this is beautiful. So definitely enjoy that. But I also enjoy just putting on some music and just going on a route that I've run a million times and just turning off the brain. So I think, yeah, both have their merits for sure.
So in 2022, so that's, goodness, maybe not even 2 years ago, Now, you set up Phoenix Ecology, Balanced Environmental Solutions, win-win scenarios that work within nature, not against it. Absolutely loved that tagline when I saw that on your website.
Thank you.
Yeah, now, you probably don't know, I wouldn't expect you to know, but in the UK, I once had my own ecological consultancy as well, yeah. And so I kind of have experience of going through the process of thinking about it, then deciding I'm going to do it, and then actually doing it, and then appreciating that there's a lot more to setting up a business than just understanding the technical aspects of what that business is there to do. There's stuff to do with health and safety, accountancy, tax, all this kind of stuff. Tell us a little bit about your experiences setting up Phoenix Ecology. Why did you do it, and what did you find most challenging to begin with? Yeah.
Why did I do it? I think because I was ready for a little bit of change in pace and challenge. I'd been working at various larger consultancies for probably more than 10 years before then, or around about 10 years perhaps. And I've really enjoyed that experience and what I've learned and all the different people that I've worked with and things that I got to do. But I had always sort of thought that maybe it might be nice to just give it a go working on your own. I mean, I definitely miss working as part of a team now, I have to be honest, but I also work with other people on various projects. So not every project I work on, I do it alone. So I still get a little bit of social contact and sort of collaboration, which I really appreciate. But I just wanted a little bit more control over my workload probably mainly, and just seeing what it's like to be your own boss basically, and that I definitely enjoy. not having to be accountable for anyone else is definitely worth the challenges that come with it. And of course there's a whole lot of challenges that you do face setting up your own business, obviously all the administrative tasks, accounting and taxes and all the health and safety paperwork and insurance and whatever else, and making sure that you've got all your bases covered. But also the financial security is a big challenge, because you don't have a guaranteed income for the next, you know, year or two. So that's definitely something that I'm slowly coming to terms with. But that was probably the biggest challenge in the beginning, is just not knowing whether in 6 months' time I would have an income.
Yeah. I've been through that. I've been through that process myself, the early days in the business that I set up. And the most important thing for any business, and even more so for a new business, is cash flow. You've got to have cash in the business bank account in order for the business to operate. And it's almost like paying yourself, especially when you're a limited company, which is slightly different from being self-employed. You are an employee of your own business. But your own business has to pay subcontractors, other suppliers, insurance premiums, as you said, accountants' fees, all that kind of stuff. And quite often you're the last person. You're the last person that's going to get paid. You're the first person that needs to get paid, but you're the last person that's probably going to get paid. I'm assuming you'll have experienced this kind of thought process. Yeah.
Well, yeah, 100%. I just got the bill from my accountant and, and I haven't paid myself yet.
Yeah. Welcome to the world of setting up your own business, folks. You know, there's lots and lots of benefits, but as the business develops and grows, you should hopefully find that over a period of time, that bank balance within the business gets bigger and bigger and bigger, And then do you get to a stage where actually paying yourself and thinking I do actually have a guaranteed income, it becomes a lot more relaxing at that point. But yeah, but for me, that probably took us a good 2-3 years in my business for me to stop worrying about that, to be honest. But yep. Different businesses are on different, lines, I suppose, from that point of view. So are there a lot of ecological consultants in your part of New Zealand? Do you have a lot of competitors, or is it mostly collaborative working? How does that work here?
There is a lot of ecological consultants. There's a lot of sort of people like me that work on their own, or perhaps with one or two people. There's a lot of large national and international ecological consultancies as well.
Okay.
In general, I like to not view it as a competitive environment. That can certainly happen. And of course, if there is a project that, you know, you're bidding for against others, then by nature it is a competitive environment. But I've never really liked to view it like that. And at the moment, we're very fortunate that there is a lot of work for ecological consultants to do. So it doesn't feel like there is 100 people scrambling for one project at any particular time. And I personally focus on the collaborative approach because I feel that you can always learn so much from working with others, and perhaps share your knowledge as well with them. So working together on different projects with different consultants has always been something that I've really enjoyed doing, because we all have a slightly different way of approaching things and a slightly different set of skills and knowledge and experience. And so learning from that, I think, is important for anyone to do, because there's always something that you haven't heard about or that you haven't thought about. So I think that's something that I really appreciate if I have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, no, I can totally understand that approach. I think that's a very healthy way to look at these things, to be fair. And I would imagine that like the United Kingdom and New Zealand, there'll be an awful lot of legislation to do with protecting the environment and ecology and stuff like that. Yes. So you'll have an awful lot of protected species, and I know there is huge concern about certain invasive species in that part of the world as well. Well, what's your typical projects look like? Do they tend to be more like what you were saying earlier, a landscape approach, or do you get, for example, species-specific projects just doing bat surveys of a particular area in connection with a development, or does it always tend to be much, much wider than that? Yeah.
It really is quite broad. Just thinking about what I'm working on at the moment, there's definitely a few quite development focused projects that I'm working on that are maybe species specific, or maybe they're just freshwater ecology, or maybe they're just terrestrial ecology. But I also have a couple of sort of more landscape focused projects, especially with regards to bats, because obviously they move around the landscape so much that ideally you always take a landscape focused approach if you're trying to trying to aim for restoring or conserving bat habitats. And so definitely personally I'm a little bit biased. I enjoy the sort of landscape focused projects because I feel like they have a better chance of creating good outcomes, especially for bats. If you have a very small development site, there's only so much you can do on that one site to help bats in a landscape scale, of course. But it is a broad range of different bigger and smaller projects, and quite narrow focuses, and also a little bit of the bigger picture thinking, up to sort of policy plan changes, things like that, that do take quite a broad landscape-based approach.
Okay, interesting. And I want to focus a little bit on bats in a moment, but in your description of yourself, you talk about birds and lizards. So Do you have, I mean, I know New Zealand has got some very special bird species that are pretty much unique to that part of the world. So I'm thinking, well, there's the kiwi is one, yeah? Do you get involved with that at all? Yeah.
I have in the past a little bit, not in a on a, any particular large scale. I have definitely enjoyed doing surveys for a slightly more cryptic critter that is really hard to find.
Yeah. Yeah. What other bird species would be regarded as high risk or regularly coming up on your project work? Anything in particular in your area that regularly comes up?
Yeah, recently, especially wetland species. There's a lot of species that live in wetlands that are at risk, threatened in New Zealand, mostly related to the fact that we've lost a large extent of wetlands across the country in the past due to agricultural land use and urbanisation and so forth. To the point where there is actually new regulation that has just been implemented to try and stop the further degradation of wetlands. But we're kind of scraping at the bottom of the pot, I'm afraid. Most of the wetlands are gone already. Depending on which region you're in, the percentage is pretty low of what is left. So alongside that, obviously bird species have also had a hard time. The other issue is predation from introduced pest species. Of course, New Zealand is a little bit special in that we don't actually have terrestrial mammals other than bats that are meant to live anywhere in the landscape. So therefore the bird species have not necessarily adapted to having things like rats and stoats and all those species predating on them. And so a lot of the wetland bird species are ground nesting and quite vulnerable to predation from those introduced pest species.
So do you get involved in invasive species work as well, or is that a different part of the sector, so to speak?
A little bit, although I'm not a specialist in the area, so it depends a little bit on the project and what is required. At a high level, definitely that's something that is part of my work. But when it comes to sort of detailed implementation of pest control for especially for larger projects, then that's normally in the field of those that have the specialised knowledge that is needed for that.
Right, folks. So if you're listening in Northwest Europe and you think about all of the debates we might have in our part of the world about trying to differentiate different species of bat, either in the hand or geographically, or through the use of acoustics, New Zealand is a little bit different when it comes to its bat diversity, so to speak. Only two species, I think. One is the long-tailed bat, and the other is the lesser short-tailed bat, but they're two totally different animals, and they behave and do things in quite different ways to each other. Hannah, do you want to tell us a little bit about these two species of bat? Tell us anything that you know about them that you feel would be important for us to know. Yeah.
Let me just jump in there. And I know you're aware of it, but I have to say there's also a third species that at least was there.
Yes.
The greater short-tailed bat, which is similar to the lesser short-tailed bat, but a lot larger. That hasn't been sighted for a very, very long time. So most people believe that it's gone extinct. There are some people that are still looking and see if we can still find it, if it might have held on some island somewhere where we haven't surveyed yet. So probably extinct, but at least I need to mention it because otherwise it would be a little bit sad. At least we had three.
Okay. And is it? Yeah, no, absolutely. And is that the same genus as the short-tailed bat? Is that a Mystacina?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Okay, so it's another species of, how would you say that the scientific name for the lesser short-tailed bat, is it Mystacina, or do you pronounce that differently?
Mystacina, yeah. But I should know Mystacina. This because I have done a lot of Latin, but
Mr. Sinas, that sounds better. That sounds better.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know which one of us is right, but I would be going with Hannah's pronunciation there.
Oh, great. I'm not putting money on myself on that one, but yeah.
Well, I'm going to be honest, up until yesterday, I had never seen that scientific name before. So I was kind of looking at it thinking, yeah. So anyway, let's stick with less a short-tailed bat. That's easier. Okay, mm-hmm. So what does bat work in New Zealand look like from a consultancy point of view? Is it searching for roosts? Are you out with bat detectors? Are you trying to catch animals to prove that they are? What does your typical bat work project look like?
Most likely the server work that we do is remote acoustic sensing, so acoustic bat monitors left out. We also do identification of potential roost trees, so sort of going through an area, especially if it is for a development where trees might have to be removed, to identify which of those trees, if bats are known to be present, to identify which ones are potential, and then either try and retain those if we can, or otherwise manage removal later on in the project. There is also probably the lesser extent of work is around roost watchers, trying to determine whether bats are in a tree or how many are using it, if it might be a maternity roost or is it a solitary roost. A little bit of thermal imaging to try and answer the same questions often. There's also radio tracking, so trapping bats and tracking them to find the exact locations of roosts. That work is not so commonly done by consultants because obviously it is a lot more expensive to do those types of surveys. You also need to permit to do that work, and so there are not that many projects generally that require that amount of detailed survey effort, and or clients willing to pay for that amount of survey effort, of course, as well. And every survey needs to be commensurate to the scale of the project. So radio tracking certainly isn't the answer to every single one of them. But yeah, in general, that tends to be done less often than the standard, which is just acoustic monitoring.
The bulk of the areas that you're working in, it's the long-tailed bat. That's the species that seeking to find. Is that correct? Yeah.
That is correct, at least for the work that I do. Long-tailed bats are more widely distributed throughout the country, and they do persist in more modified landscapes. So there's a few urban centres that have long-tailed bats that live at least in the peri-urban environment or sometimes in the urban environment, whereas the lesser short-tailed bat is very much confined to the larger, more untouched areas of bush that we have left in the country. So you wouldn't go out and look for a short-tailed bat in the city because they cannot persist in that landscape. So by nature of the work that I do, which is often sort of more development-focused work, there is no... Luckily, not very often development work happening in those forests, because a lot of them are protected areas where no work can be done, luckily, of course. So, yeah, I don't come across the short-tailed bats in my work, typically. I have in the sort of training and experience that I've gained over the years, I have, but not very often. Yeah, it's long-tailed bats that most of my work is focused on.
So you're doing an acoustic survey, okay, static bat detectors, trying to record bat echolocation. You don't need to sit down and debate what species of bat it is, because pretty much all of the time, it's only going to be one species of bat that you can actually record. Is that correct?
Yeah, most of the time. Sometimes when, and I've come across that mainly with community groups, for example, that are doing bat monitoring, and they might be going out into slightly sort of larger pieces of bush somewhere where We don't think there is short-tailed bats, but you also don't ever want to rule it out. And so occasionally there is some monitoring that comes back as, could there possibly be a short-tailed bat? But that doesn't happen very often. And certainly I haven't come across that in my work that I've done. It's more sort of supporting community groups and the analysis of the data that they collect that I might have trained in the past to install monitors and read the data or something along those lines. So most of the time it's pretty straightforward. Yeah, it's maybe a little bit boring, but it also makes life a lot easier when you know what you're dealing with.
Right, I'm going to ask you a couple of geeky questions now, and you may not know the answers to these questions. Okay. But when it comes to the typical echolocation calls as they appear on a spectrogram of long-tailed bat versus short-tailed bat, are they quite distinctively different to each other, or are they similar from the point of view? Could you get one confused for the other if both species were present in the same location, so to speak?
Yeah, they generally are distinct. They do have a slightly different pattern and sort of the frequencies that they cover in the but they also have social calls, and sometimes those can be a lot more similar than the general sort of foraging or commuting echolocation calls that they make. So you should be able to tell them apart, but if, say, a bat flew past a little bit too far away from the microphone, and so the recording is a little bit shallow, a little bit grainy, maybe not quite as clear as it should be, then there can definitely be situations where you're not 100% sure what it might be. But as I said, that happens mostly just with like research where we're researching in areas that contains both species. Most of the time, with the work that I do, that has never happened because they don't overlap with the habitat that I'm surveying.
Next geeky question. I'm assuming the short-tailed bat is a tree roosting bat predominantly. Long-tailed bat, you mentioned, is a tree roosting bat, but do you also find long-tailed bats in structures or?
We don't exactly know. They have been found in, I believe, an attic once or twice, which is more anecdotal evidence than anything. It is not common that happens, but it hasn't really been looked into in a detailed way yet. We don't know whether they're perhaps starting to adapt to the fact that structures are present, because, of course, in New Zealand, sort of large buildings haven't been present for as long as they have been in Europe by any means of the description. So maybe they're slowly discovering that might be a good place to roost. Maybe they're also just running out of habitat in urban environments and starting to have to branch out, but that is just pure speculation on my behalf. There hasn't really been any research into it that has given us answers to that.
I got a couple of more batty questions. Okay. Let's just stick on the ecology. There is something quite special about short-tailed bat that makes it different to, I think, every other bat on the planet, certainly any other bat species that I know. Do you want to talk about its foraging style? Because it is
definitely
very different. Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, they are a little bit quirky. They certainly fly and can catch insects on the wing, and then they do that, often quite low. But they also walk over the forest floor and forage there. And so they sort of walk around on their knuckles, which looks very cute. And as I said earlier, we don't have any rodent species, for example, that were native to the country. And so they've sort of taken on that niche of, say, a mouse that's foraging on the ground, and they actually look quite mousy when they do it, sort of fold up their wings, and you almost wouldn't know that it's a bat. I think that is pretty cool. And they also have a function as a pollinator for a threatened plant species that, alongside the short-tailed bat, which is its pollinator, unfortunately, is a threatened plant species as well. So that's pretty pretty cool.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Right, last batty question. What kind of bat detectors do you use? What make, what brand do you use?
For standardized surveys, our government authority, the Department of Conservation, is manufacturing monitors that we all use, and that just means that all the surveys that we do sort of compare can be compared to each other across the years, and then amongst everyone that goes out and does surveys. And so yeah, it's basically manufactured by that department, and consultants can buy them, and community groups use them too. So there is definitely an advantage in everyone using the same equipment. It's just has been a challenge at times to get more equipment because it's only coming from one place, and there's only so many that they can make at any particular time. So it is a bit of a scramble sometimes to get additional monitoring equipment based on that. And I think there are some consultancies that are branching out now and try and compare the performance of the different monitors to then be able to use different models as well.
Yeah, okay. And I'm assuming these are full spectrum bat detectors, or no?
Not at the moment, no. They're focused on the spectrum that we require to monitor the two species in New Zealand. So they wouldn't necessarily be as expensive to be used in, say, Europe for the species, especially in the higher frequencies. I think they would not likely pick those up. I'm not quite sure exactly where the frequency finishes. That's too detailed a question, but I can look that up.
That's okay. That's totally cool. That's totally cool.
Fail the exam.
But yeah. Obviously, I've got a strong interest in bat acoustics. So yeah. I did say to you before I started asking you these geeky questions
very much into geeky questions.
that's brilliant stuff. Brilliant. Okay, really, really interesting. thank you. I think that's given us a bit of an insight as to what life looks like from a consultancy perspective and from a bat consultancy type perspective in New Zealand. Do you use a particular software package for the analysis? Does everybody use the same package, or is there more freedom as to what software you can use?
There is different types of software that you can use, although the monitors do come with a standard, really basic software that I tend to use over others. Some other people have got different opinions and preferences on what they want to use, depending on what you're wanting to do with it as well. But yeah, it comes just with a very basic script that allows you to analyze the spectrogram.
Okay, that is taking us almost to the end, folks. And what I like to do at this point, Hannah, is I sit here and I think, is there anything that we should have spoken about that I've forgotten to mention, or you've forgotten to mention? While you're thinking about that, I am going to say that, like we do quite often when we do talking about interviews, we ask our guest to nominate a charity of their choice, and Batability then gives a small donation to that charity in our guest's name. So at some point in the coming weeks, we will be doing that on behalf of Hannah. So Hannah, was there anything that we've missed, anything that you want to add before we close things off?
Yeah, possibly just briefly, that may have come through some of the answers that I've given. There's a challenge in New Zealand that there's a lot that we don't know about bats, because we're sort of still catching up on studying them, and a lot more work is going into conservation these days as there has been in the past. And while we only have two species, there's still a lot of mysteries and things that we don't understand, especially when it comes to conservation and how the way that we use the land might impact bats. We don't know much about the effects of development. We don't really know much about how solar farms might impact them, how wind farms might impact them. And the list is endless of the questions that we still need to answer and the research that we still need to do. And so I just wanted to give a brief plug for a research organization that a colleague of mine has just recently founded that I'm a board member of, because we're very fresh. But the whole idea behind that organization is to drive research into bat conservation into the future, to allow us to answer those questions and to better manage the way that we impact bats across the landscape scale. So it's just called the Bat Research Organization. And I can give you a link if you like, if that's appropriate.
Absolutely. Yes.
People to visit the website. It's still very fresh at this point in time, but we're really excited to get on board a few excited individuals to start basically fundraising and driving more research, working with obviously with other stakeholders across the industry, because without collaboration it's not possible to achieve much, but that's definitely something that is much needed for us.
Brilliant. Absolutely liking that lots. So what we're going to do, folks, as well as giving you the link to Phoenix Ecology's website underneath the video if you're watching on Club, we will also include the link to the Bat Research Organization. And if you're listening to this at some point in the more distant future as a podcast, we'll include links to both of those places within the script of the podcast. So be delighted to do that. Thank you. Thanks for mentioning that. And how was it? What were you feeling beforehand and how are you feeling now?
Just quite happy before and after. It's wonderful to be sharing a little bit about our small corner of the world with others, because we are a little bit tucked away. Really appreciate the opportunity to do that.
No, absolutely. And as soon as the opportunity presented itself, and I'm going to have a little bit of a shout out here for Inga Kargart from Copenhagen, a good friend of mine. It was Inga that introduced Hannah to myself a couple of months ago now and suggested that this could actually be a good interview to do. And Inga, if you're listening, you're absolutely spot on. I've absolutely loved this, and we found out a lot about stuff that's different to what we would normally talk about on these talking bat type interviews. So what we're going to do now, Hannah, is I'm going to thank you. And then after I thank you, if you just close off with one or two sentences, and then we'll just finish the interview there. So everybody, that was Dr. Hannah Muller of Phoenix Ecology talking about life as a environmental ecological consultant in New Zealand. It's been fascinating stuff. I've really enjoyed learning all about everything that Hannah's had to talk about. And I just want to say massive, massive thanks to Hannah for her time today. And hopefully you found it interesting, inspiring, and lots of other adjectives that would be appropriate. And to close things off, I'm just going to ask Hannah to close things off, say goodbye. Over to you, Hannah. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Neil. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about bats in New Zealand and my journey, and share sort of where I've come from and where we're going to, hopefully way more research into the future. I've spent the last couple of months, especially also in the past, but now that I'm here, I'm trying to learn a little bit more about bats in Europe. And I've really enjoyed getting to know the little quirks that come with it. Thanks to Inga, especially, also doing a lot of bat spotting in Copenhagen. So it's nice to sort of return the favor and share a little bit of knowledge from where I come from and what we do. So yeah, again, thank you for the opportunity to be able to do that. I've very much enjoyed it.
We hope you enjoyed this Talking Bat interview, which is an edited audio-only version of the original video session. The full version, including video, is available via Bitability Club, our online training platform. To find out more about Club, go to bitability.co.uk. Till next time, thank you.